we present the news quiz with your chairman, Simon Horrett.
Hello and welcome again to the news quiz. We start with a cutting from the Coulston and Purley Advertiser, read by Brian Perkins.
The woman was later taken to hospital, but escaped virtually unharmed.
Thank you to everyone who sent that in. Now let's meet the teams. Will you welcome first on my right, writer, broadcaster, comedian Andy Hamilton, and novelist and TV critic Lynn Truss. And facing them on my left, humorist Alan Corran and comedian Jeremy Hardy. And before we start round one, here's a story from the Daily Mail.
Britain's longest-serving traffic warden, Marlene Hale, from Downhatherley near Gloucester, will visit Highgrove House today to receive a police award marking 25 years' service from the Prince of Wales.
Thanks to Mrs. M. Kogar of Cardiff for that one. Andy, your first question. Who took French leave to meet his Waterloo?
This was this smoothie, Monsieur Chirac, who came over, and amazingly, within a day, we're supposed to like the French. Quite an achievement. He came over, and we threw a big banquet for him, and he said how valued Britain is. We made him come into Waterloo Station, and we made him sit at the banquet beneath a big mural of the Battle of Waterloo. And to the dinner, which included all the heads of state, obviously, but we also invited Rob Andrew, who, as I recall, starred in several thrashings of the French at rugby. And he got up and he was very polite and nice about us and said how much we valued and everything. And we just sat there thinking, you can't trust him, he's French.
You missed out the fact they made him kiss Princess Margaret. Yeah, he didn't sober up for 2 days.
I was fascinated that he congratulated Britain on our success in tackling unemployment. I thought, well, he's obviously a bit confused about where he is. And he kept going on about the war. He kept going on about how we were great mates in the war, Britain and France, and now he's trying to get us to become part of United Germany.
Mr. Chirac may or may not be a goalist, but he had long talks with Mr. Major, who is definitely an own goalist. He eventually agreed to support exports of British tallow and gelatine. Terrific news for all continentals who like to eat trifle by candlelight.
It wasn't only that, it was semen as well, let's be honest. Gelatine, tallow and semen, and what kind of ghastly concoction, what kind of frightening blancmange would be you making out of it?
2 points to whoever in the mists of history answered that question. Lynn, welcome to the news quiz.
Thank you.
Whose hot air increased as their gas was cut?
He's talking amongst himself.
Something to do with gas. I can't really give you much of a hint.
Well, I guess it was to do with gas.
Yes.
It's
British gas.
Yes, Claire Spottiswoode.
Yeah. Tell me.
She forced British Gas to slash their prices. And all the poor sods, poor Sids, sorry, that's the... who bought shares are complaining that... that she was too strict.
Oh, yeah. It rings a bell.
Rings a bell.
Which is more than your gas fitter does. British Gas said that a proposed reduction in bills would mean slow service and poor workmanship, as if the public would notice the difference. So 2 points for that lot, and we move over now to Jeremy, whose test results have all been left in a spin.
Ah, this is the appalling Michael Howard. The equipment the police use for fitting up Irish people is faulty. It's faulty because it leaves traces of the fit-up, and this is a problem with a lot of their equipment. Some of it leaves traces, some of it leaves bruises, and in this case, they've realised this equipment is dodgy, and Michael Howard was forced to come to the Commons and admit that there may have been miscarriage of justice. But he said it's all right because there may be as few as 12 cases where there's been a miscarriage of justice, and it's all right because he won't do anything about it anyway, because he never does. But I was alarmed about this. The press reaction to this is, whenever they know that people may have been wrongly convicted and are going to come out, they get in the word terrorist and killer as many times as they can before they can be sued. So all these people who we may find out were not terrorists at all are being berated for being such as much as possible in the intervening months.
That's quite understandable, though, because if you looked at the pictures of that centrifuge thing, it was a little bung right at the bottom. And if you were using a washing-up brush, it just wouldn't go. It just wouldn't go right to the bottom. You know, you'd be doing this.
You can never get the last bit out, can you?
No, you can't.
I blame Inspector Morse for all this, because I think what happens is all those shows give us a sort of false idea of the authority and competence of forensic scientists. Because in Morse, isn't he, the forensic scientist is, well, Morse, we found a little bit of Axminster carpet under her fingernails and some soil that you only find in one particular part of Norfolk. He doesn't say, I'm sorry, Morse, I've contaminated the sample because I had a pizza and I forgot to wash my hands.
Question referred to the contaminated forensic equipment which might have secured false convictions for terrorist offences. The Home Office did admit that there was a slim, theoretical possibility that the unthinkable might happen. But, on the other hand, Michael Howard probably wouldn't resign. 2 points to Jeremy. Alan, here's a piece of music for you.
Oh, she is cruel and heartless. Two-pack me for Gordon. Just cos he's better looking than me. Just cos he's cool and trendy. But I know he's a moron. Gordon is a moron. Gordon is a moron. Gordon is a moron.
What?
Not actually a song called Gordon is a Moron, but Jilted John, performed by, surprisingly, Jilted John. Alan, how is the red rose getting prickly?
I don't understand any of that. It's like doing a crossword. The only Gordon that's been in the news is the one who was established as not being gay Gordon by Sue Lawley. Are we talking about old Brownnose?
No other.
We're talking about Gordon Brownnose?
Yeah.
Yes, thought we might. Well, he's having a fight with John Prescott.
Yes.
To gladden the heart of all Tories. I mean, he's come up with some enormously complicated scheme, which he's shrouded in polysyllables and gone on for several days telling them about it until the whole of the front bench has dropped off. And the only one staying awake is Prescott. And Prescott's simply telling him that he's no use. He's a sad man. He ought to get out, go. He's not a real socialist and doesn't speak English. And no one understands a word of what he's talking about. New Labour, new nonsense, new gabbling, new gobbledygook. Hold on, so they're going to get rid of him.
Prescott says to Brown that no one understands a word of what he's saying.
I know. It's sad, isn't it?
That's very sad.
Prescott's not a proper socialist either. He's just fat with the Yorkshire accent. You can be full, because just because you can see someone's vest through their shirt, it doesn't make them a socialist.
Tony Blair has appealed to Gordon Brown, John Prescott and Peter Mandelson to stop arguing amongst themselves and to unite against the real enemy, Harriet Harman. So the scores at the end of round one are, everybody, 4. We start round 2 with an item seen in the Radcliffe Advertiser.
Plans to build a crematorium in the borough first came up last year. There are no similar facilities nearby, and residents are forced to travel to Rochdale if they want to be cremated.
Thank you, Alan Barrett of Manchester, for spotting that. Round 2, and Andy, who's saying sorry by the side of the road?
This is our government, God bless them. The Conservative Party have paid, I think they paid one of the Saatchis, and Tim Bell, who I've never quite understood his function, but he always seems to be there. They paid them £8 million or something to come up with the idea of a big blue poster with the words, yes, it hurt, yes, it worked, on it, which of course means that all over the country these posters are being defaced with things like, yes, you're crap, yes, we'll vote you out, and it's this wizard campaign slogan that they've come up with, because apparently the Tories did some research and they discovered that the British people feel that they're arrogant and that a show of humility. Now what happens in Japan if a minister makes a public mistake, admits liability, is that they're forced to actually get on their knees and bow before people and publicly apologise, sometimes even, I think, on television. I think we could do that. Actually, don't have, Don't they chop their heads off as well? I think we could do that. Anyway, that's what it is. It's the new campaign.
For some reason, it's been interpreted as saying sorry, though. I just don't understand that.
No, it's not
like
really
sorry,
is it? It's kind
yes,
of...
It hurt
and it was quite funny.
it sounds like an exchange between two inept first-time lovers, doesn't it? One says, yes, it hurt. The other one says, yes, it worked. It's really rather horrible.
Jeremy, here's a piece of music for you. Jeremy, who admitted he admitted what young men?
It's his old mother Runcie, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. Robert Runcie has admitted that he knowingly, not in the biblical sense, but knowingly ordained gays, and fair play to him, why not? But this has caused a huge backlash among traditionalists, which are what we used to call bigots in the church. And, rather an alarming prospect, the idea of fundamentalist Anglicans. Sounds like a contradiction in terms, that is, of Shiite jumble sales or suicide car boot sales. But there's a man, George Austin, who's the Archdeacon of York or something, who's been quoting Leviticus, and you're always on shaky ground unless you're an Orthodox Jew quoting Leviticus, because he quotes chapter 22 verse 13 of Leviticus, which says it's an abomination to be gay. Unfortunately, chapter 11 verse 12 says it's an abomination to eat shellfish. Not only that, but chapter 22 verse 15 says that if a man should lie with a beast, then not only he, but the beast must be put to death. So presumably it must have led him on in some way by saying Eeyore when it meant yes.
I'm getting very confused, but did he ordain any shellfish? Where are we going with this?
No, what I'm saying, the point I'm making, Alan, is that George Austin cites Leviticus, which is full of all manner of inane nonsense.
Right.
And gobbledygook about the fact you can't eat shellfish and things.
I don't think it's fair to attack Leviticus because he can't answer back.
Well, it was all about Runcie sort of not ever asking the question.
Mm.
Don't ask the question. Oh. And you've got to know how to do that. I don't like dropping names, but a year or so ago, at the height of the Richard Gere hamster crisis, I met Michael Caine at a party, and Caine lives about three houses from Richard Gere and then Cindy Crawford in Bel Air. And I'm not an intrusive man, and I've nothing else to talk to him about. I said, Michael, is Richard Gere gay? And he said, put it this way, he'd help out if they were short-handed. And I thought, you know, that's the way you've got to ask questions if you're the Archbishop of Canterbury, isn't it?
Should we do something they can broadcast now?
Do you want me to quote more from Leviticus?
This was Lord Runcie, who admitted he'd had gay clergymen under him when he was Archbishop of Canterbury. At least he thought some of them were probably gay, but he didn't like to ask. Instead, he just looked out for those who handed out little portions of quiche with the communion wine. Alan, your question, who took the sofa after refusing to take the stand?
It's not about O.J. Simpson and Richard and that little fat woman, is it? O.J. Simpson, they're supposed to have paid him £1. This seems really strange. I mean, it shows the man is barking mad. Perhaps it's part of a plea in case an appeal is ever made. But he came over here and he sat there with Richard and Judy. Which is punishment enough. People will now feel he's discharged his debt to society. I mean, most of us offered Richard and Judy would rather take the dead man walking cry and just fry quietly. Yes, he came over and he went to the Oxford Union and he said they were smarter than all his lawyers, which was very... And lots of pictures of him, real photo opportunity of him leaning out of windows and waving and things like that. And a rather terrifying one of O.J. Simpson with his arm round a woman. And he's got hands like octopuses.
In fact, he flew out the other day, didn't he? We may be able to use that after all.
What do you mean he flew out the other day? I'm not afraid of him. He won't come home late at night pissed and batter me, I'll tell you. Not driving my car down the freeway at 90 miles an hour. The warrant is still on it. If anything goes wrong with that fan belt, he's a dead man.
There was also a picture of him with Michael Winner with the caption, "The most reviled man in England," with O.J. Simpson.
Didn't he say he was going to spend all his waking hours looking for the murderer? So that logically, that means that he's narrowed it down to Richard Madeley or loads of upper-class kids called Rupert at Oxford University.
So the scores at the end of round two are, everybody, 8. Andy, who threw the book at miles of empty shelves?
This is the new British Library building behind...
It is.
I know it is, I just said it was.
Good. Lynn, your question.
You're just trying to pad now, because there's none of that last stuff we can use. We've got 25 minutes to do, I know. This is about the new British Library behind St Pancras, which apparently doesn't function terribly well as a library. Partly because they've got this flash new shelf system that tips all the books off. I think it's rather good, because libraries can be dull. But, it went £8 trillion over budget. And they made ludicrous errors, and it took an incredibly long time. And Prince Charles doesn't like it, because it's not made from organic rosewood or something. And that's it, really.
The question concerns the new British Library, whose 12 million books are now 9 years overdue. The library's design has been widely condemned. Prince Charles described it as groping for some symbolic significance, and he should know. Lynn, here's a piece of music for you.
Till we meet once again, you and I, wish me luck as you wave me goodbye.
Lynn, who wished they could have waved her goodbye?
Well, apparently, someone's written this book that says that Vera Lynn was a force sort of evil, really, in the Second World War, that she filled all our boys with squishy-squashy sort of feelings when they should have been out there, you know, killing the Hun, and that it was a terribly bad idea.
How bizarre. Well, what sort of music do they think our boys should have had? Meatloaf?
Lily Marlene, isn't it? It's a strange thing that Lily Marlene was the most successful song. They heard Lily Marlene and went out and wanted to kill Germans. They were inspired to do it. It's a wonderful thought, isn't it?
Mind you, it is a dreadful song.
No, it's wonderful.
And it's a German song.
I'll sing it if you like.
Go on, then.
Go on.
In
German. Vor der Laterne durch den stillen Mund steht sich wie in Träume dein geliebter Mund. Dort wird die Welt das Ende sehen. Wer wird bei der Laterne stehen als du, Lily Marlene, als du?
Serves you right.
All together now.
God, I feel like taking to Brooke again now.
That was absolute filth.
Well, it inspired the truth.
How can somebody be allowed to sing that on Radio 4?
He was making it up. It's just loads of German road signs strung together.
This is the news that the BBC wanted to ban Vera Lynn during the war because she was worrying the troops. However, producers fought valiantly to keep Vera's show on the air for years and years, even though everybody hated it, a policy Chris Evans is deeply grateful for. So 2 points to whoever that was. And Jeremy, who will wipe the floor with their treatment?
Ah, this is the Royal Hallamshire Hospital in Sheffield. Their managers have decided it costs too much to staff the hospital using nurses. So they've been casting around for people who are even less well paid than nurses, which means they've had their work cut out for them and doubtless pay themselves very well for this. And so they've been looking for people paid less than nurses. They tried agricultural labourers. And thought, well, they'd have to travelling expenses and so forth. And so they then realised that under their very noses were hospital cleaners who are paid a grand less than nurses, which means most of them are emaciated and naked. And so they've got cleaners in to look after patients on the haematology ward.
That's when they wanted to shout out swab. They knew they'd be able to shout out swab and someone would come in with a mop.
Stick it inside you. No, thank you.
Well, they'll have a good bedside manner, because if somebody says, look, I'm approaching the end of my life, you can say, never mind that, I've been cleaning out the carsies for the last 4 hours. You think you've got problems?
This is the announcement from the Royal Hampshire Hospital, Sheffield, where cleaners are to take over nurses' traditional duties. One said he didn't mind taking temperatures, but he wasn't looking forward to having to sleep with a senior registrar. Patients who are worried that they may be treated by someone who's just been cleaning the toilet are advised to go private. There they change rubber gloves between jobs. So at the end of round three, Andy and Lynn have 12 points, but Alan and Jeremy have just nosed into the lead with 13. Andy, listen to this, please.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. These broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arrive.
I'm sure you don't need the question, Andy, but where are blackbirds alarming?
We know this one, Lynn, don't we?
Yeah, we know this.
This is a story. It's from Cleveland. Do I get a point for that?
Yes. Yeah.
There you are. Lovely.
Gisborough.
Another point.
Yes?
Gisborough, Cleveland. And they've got some very talented blackbirds up there who can... They can do all the usual beautiful things that you get. You know, like when dawn comes up, you hear a blackbird in a tree, and you think, what a wonderfully English sound, that sort of crystal singing, that tone. These blackbirds can do that, but they can also do the sound of car alarms, which goes down very well round their way at 5 a.m. And... it's a bit of a problem. I should think it's quite loud, the sound of the blackbirds impersonating the car alarms. Not as loud as the sound of shotguns being fired at the blackbird, I suspect. But that's the story anyway. And what happens if they pass on this talent? They could drive the whole country mad.
Maybe people breaking into blackbirds. Has that occurred to you? Very dim kids, hot wiring blackbirds.
There's something in Leviticus about entering a blackbird.
This all happened in the Yorkshire town of Gisborough, where blackbirds have learned to imitate car alarms. They've been doing it for ages, but everyone ignored them. Some years ago, thrushes learned to sound like telephones, becoming so convincing they even waited until you'd got into the bath before starting. Lynn, what flightless bird took off with a favourite?
Ostrich steaks.
Yes.
Is this the thing? Yeah. Apparently, well, because we don't eat beef or anything anymore, and apparently it's perfectly all right to eat ostrich. It's very yummy and low in cholesterol and things, so they're serving on British Airways. And people are pretending not to notice, I suppose. But I don't know why.
Well, we're going to have them over here, aren't we? We're going to have a very quick herdsman, though. I'm trying to catch an ostrich. I'll it down. Obviously, I've done it, but... put up a bit of a fight.
Leviticus again. It's British Airways who've decided to serve ostriches in first-class cabins. In the past, they politely asked them to go back to the cheap seats.
They were there.
BA have arranged to use only humanely reared ostriches that are kept in a caring way right up until the time someone wrings their necks. Jeremy, what rough test proved who is our best friend?
Psychologists or psychoanalysts or pet psychoanalysts have analysed dogs, and they've drawn up categories of good and bad dogs. And they've worked these out because... if you look at the categories, they've worked out that the dogs that work for the police and attack children in the park are horrible, vicious dogs. And the dogs that sort of nuzzle politely and drool and help blind people are nice, friendly dogs. And I think it must be more elaborate than that, the testing. They must have got Anthony Clare to get them, get off the couch, get them up and come on now. to get them up on the on psychiatrist's chair and say things like, now Rover, this need you have to drink the water from the toilet and fornicate with cushions. Is this some kind of attempt to assert your natural primeval instincts over your suburban environment? I imagine that's what happened.
This was the report that graded dogs for suitability as pets by psychoanalysis. The Golden Labrador came up best, though it was judged to be very immature, which is why a Labrador puppy thinks that stealing your toilet roll is a stunningly funny prank. Alan, why might all creatures, great and small, include a word from their sponsor?
This is not about Lord Montague adopting a dung beetle.
Yeah, it is.
I think it is. What a sad man. What a poor sense of history's memory this man has. Lord Montague has adopted a dung beetle under the guidance of John Gummer. Because certain animals are threatened. You would think the dung beetle would be threatened, wouldn't you? For all sorts of reasons. But anyway, it's been taken under the wing of Lord Montague, and now it's going to be all right. And lots of other people are adopting a similar threatened species under a sponsorship scheme.
Yes. Right?
What is Gummer up to? I bet he ate the rest of his daughter's hamburger. Man.
You see dung beetles in the zoo, they kind of push the big ball of dung, you know, until they get to a nice size. Then one of them sits on top, doesn't he? And another one tries to get up on top of the ball of dung. And I've often watched them thought, how very like life.
And before we reveal the final scores, let's see what cuttings the teams have brought along. Andy.
Right, well, I'm indebted to Charlie Lloyd of Halt Whistle, who sent me this from the Newcastle Journal. It's about an armed raid. The gunman is described as 5'9", very thin, with a prominent chin and wearing a dark jumper, khaki shirt and jeans. The man with the hammer is described as 5'8", thick-set, wearing a black jumper and shiny tracksuit bottoms. The third man, who stayed just inside the door, is said to be similar to the other two.
Flynn.
Right, this is from the Times. The life of a journalist is never easy, but one veteran on the Daily Mirror is really going through the mill. After a tipple or two with his chums after work, he tends to fall asleep on the train home to Harpenden in Hertfordshire and wake up at the end of the line in Bedford. One night, when he missed his stop, he reboarded the train in Bedford, fell asleep again, and woke up back in London. Drastic measures were called for, so he boarded the train one night in London and placed a sign around his neck saying, "Please wake me up at Harpenden." Sadly, he woke up in Bedford again to find that someone had written "Tee-hee" on his sign.
Jeremy, you're clipping.
This is from the South Coventry and Kenilworth Citizen, and it says, John Butcher, the Tory MP for Coventry South West, urged parents in the area to keep a closer check on the activities of their children. There is some suspicion that rug pushers are seeking them out and selling their wares, he said.
Alan.
I got one from the Birmingham Mail, Simon. It woken in the small hours of last Tuesday by the frantic mewing of his cat in the garden beneath his bedroom window, Peter Marriott, a 36-year-old Solihull lab technician, went downstairs to investigate and found a burglar stuck in the cat flap.
Thank you all, and now let's look at the final scores, which are Andy and Lynn, 16 points, and because I fiddled the scores, Alan and Jeremy are the winners with 17 points. That's all for this week, but before we leave you, here's a cutting from Computer Weekly, sent in by J.S. Hillmore of North London.
Scunthorpe residents have been denied access to the internet because of the town's place name. The four letters in the middle of the town's name trigger obscene language censors. The town is now to be referred to as Scunthorpe.
And with that, goodbye. Taking part in News Quiz, Alan Corran, Andy Hamilton, Jeremy Hardy and Lynn Truss.
The chairman was Simon Hoggart, and the news was read by me, Brian Perkins. The programme was written by Ian Pattinson, with Hugh Rycroft and Adam Bostock-Smith. The producer was Alan Evans.